Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, we're going to introduce some murderers. Members of Santa Fe's theater community, under the auspices of Chamber Theater, are presenting an intimate staged reading of the play Murderers on Friday, June 6th at 7:30 in the evening. It's at and for the benefit of the Santa Fe Art Institute on the college of the campus of Santa Fe. I'd like to welcome director Richard Block, KSFR's own Richard Block. And I would like to welcome Minka Lupino, a murderer who is inhabiting the body of actress Karen Lee, and murderer Lucy Stickler, who is inhabiting the body of actress Lois Viscoli. Welcome, murderers and gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Glad to see you.
There is one murderer who won't be with us today, and that is the character Gerald Halverson, being played by Matt Page.
Okay. So, Richard, tell us about this. It's not exactly a play. It's a staged reading.
Yes, well, it's an unusual, extremely well-written piece. It's three monologues given by people who are the most improbable people ever to murder anyone. And when we were all read it together for the first time, we were just laughing the whole time. It's very funny, and with lots of unexpected little twists and turns and constant touches of irony, shall we say. It's a lot of fun.
Now, this is a work by Jeffrey Hatcher. Who's that?
I'm not going to be able to tell you much about Jeffrey Hatcher. There is some information, but I don't really, I can't say much about him, except that he writes very well. And in this particular case, he's come up with some delightful monologues.
Minka Lupino, where are you from?
Oh, well, Florida.
And so how did you get into the murder business? Is this your first murder?
Well, it kind of started with one, and then it kind of grew into more and more and more.
Now, when you did the first one, did you feel bad?
Yeah, but I kind of felt just.
What were the circumstances under which you committed it?
Well, I've seen a lot of retirees come into the retirement center. I deal with them. They're very nice. And I've seen a lot of their relatives put them there. And I guess one day I just snapped.
Now, you are a nurse, or you work with them in some capacity?
I'm an administrative assistant.
So, without giving away the play in which Karen is playing you, how'd you do it and why?
Well, I did it kind of on the cuff, like right at the moment. I didn't really plan it, but it seemed like such a great situation to put the plan through. And without giving too much away, let's just say that two people who were relatives of someone that just had died put themselves in a position where they wouldn't get much air.
They had it coming to them.
Yeah.
Let me just inject here quickly that all three of these monologues take place at Riddle Key, which is a retirement community in Florida.
Riddle
Key. Riddle Key.
So this is a place where not only the old go to die.
True. Yeah.
Well, it's very rarely the old that do die. It's often surrounding folks or family members.
Now, Lucy Stickler, inhabiting the body of Lois Viscoli, what is your story?
Well, I've retired to Riddle Key with my husband, Bob, and we're enjoying life in a lovely condo near the water, and life is very blissful until a certain person comes to town that we have known previously, and certain things arise, certain circumstances that make it extremely uncomfortable for me to have her around. And However, I'm a very lighthearted person, and I do things with a gentle touch. I don't know that I can tell you much more without giving a lot away. But I am a very easygoing person, and I think carefully about everything I do. And I generally can put things together very quickly in my mind. And I take advantage of the situation that I'm in.
Can I just give a little editorial note here? The woman who comes to town is named Margaret Fadel, and her major occupation or habit in life is to collect husbands, always other women's husbands.
Uh-oh.
And that sort of sets the scene here.
Dangerous business indeed.
Indeed.
So we're talking about the staged reading of the play Murderers, which is happening on Friday the 6th of June at 7:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute. If the murderers would leave their the bodies that they're inhabiting for a moment, I would like to ask Karen Lee, what's it like to play a murderer?
Well, it's something I actually never thought of doing or reading. So it's I suppose because coming from her viewpoint, these people kind of, you know, it's sort of like living out that fantasy that people have sometimes of doing away with someone, perhaps, that, of course, I never have that fantasy, but others might, doing away with someone or someone getting their just desserts that treat other people poorly. So she thinks of herself probably as sort of a house cleaner of sorts.
What about you, Lois?
Well, I think the whole idea of murder is quite fun. It's very interesting to be able to plot something and to carry it through and see how things fall into place, as it were. I think I basically have always been a very cheerful, happy housewife, and I still am. However, I am prone to feeling a little jealous.
You, Lois, or you, your character?
I'm my character.
Ah.
It's very difficult for me to jump from one to the other. I've kind of enjoyed this character so much.
You just can't get out.
I can't get
out. Watch out, Santa Fe.
Yeah, but it's a joy to do it, and I'm used to doing much more serious stuff. So this is kind of a delight and fun. And it is, I guess we would term it a black comedy. Do you agree, Richard?
Well, I don't know. It doesn't even seem very black to me.
There is the thing that comes up when you read. I used to, as a teenager, I read innumerable murder mysteries. I don't know why, but Agatha Christie and everybody else. And there are always these moral questions of, did they have it coming to them? And therefore, is it wrong?
Well, we're all fascinated with murder. I mean, Clue, the game Clue, all these different games we play, it's sort of a kind of a fantasy thing. And I think every one of us has people that we would hate to see killed. But if anyone was going to get killed, we might like to have a chance to name some members of the list. Let me say also that Matt, who wasn't able to be with us today, he's playing this character in a monologue which is titled The Man Who Married His Mother-in-Law. And I think maybe that's titillating enough.
I'd like to call Minka Lupino back into the body of Karen Lee and ask if she would like to read a little piece from the play Murderers.
Sure. I am a murderer many times over. I do not like the term serial killer, which to my mind suggests an emphasis on the numerical followed by too much time spent on the interstate highway system. My murders all took place in one locality. Now, I should say right here at the beginning, I am not ashamed of having committed murder. You see, I believe in what is right, in justice, and every murder I ever planned, save one, was planned in that spirit of rightness, fairness, and justice. The kind of murder planning that I like to think our forefathers would have approved of. Besides, I was not always a murderer. Murderers are not born that way. The works of J.G. Garland have taught me that. J.G. Garland is my favorite author, the greatest mystery writer of all time, whose detective, Gay Broadway impresario Jolly St. Jolly, is always stumbling into murders along the Great White Way. J.G. Garland is the author of Murder with the Lunts, Murder with Carol Channing, and his magnum opus, Murder with the Cast of the Chorus Line at Sardi's after the show. He taught me that murderers have their reasons, usually splashy and interesting reasons with a lot of diabolical planning that is nonetheless foiled when Jolly sees through their one big mistake, usually having to do with theater arcana such as who was the last heterosexual to win a Tony for Best Costume Design. I've been reading this man since I was in high school, and the day he came down to live at Riddle Key Luxury Senior Retirement Living Center and Golf Course, well, you can imagine. I wanted to tell him how exciting it was that he was taking one of the new villas, how I was such a fan, how whenever there was a lull in the members' office and Mr. Finn was out showing a prospective couple around, I'd sneak out my copy of Murder with the Merm, or Nine Novenas to Die, or Cock the Gun Slowly, all in paperback, of course. I can't afford the hard copies. But I've never said a word to him. For someone of his stature, Mr. Finn handled all of the details himself. I've never even heard Mr. Garland's voice over the phone. At least that's the way it was before. Before I ever thought I'd meet him. Before I became a murderer.
And that's Minka Lupino. And now let's go to Lucy Stickler. Murderer.
It all began when Margaret Fadel came to town. I should say Margaret Morrison Fadel Haverland Keith Spreckney Fadel, which tells you something about Margaret's marital history. After her husbands would die or divorce her, she never ended up rich enough to take it easy, but she'd always end up on her feet and in very nice shoes. I figured she couldn't always be in it for the money. I mean, some of it must have been for sport. Well, I hadn't seen her in a nun's age, and then one day, Margaret Fadel comes to town. That was 6 weeks ago. And now she's throwing her own welcoming party. And we're invited. Well, everybody's invited, not just the men she slept with and the women she ruined. That afternoon, I go into Dr. Nagengupta, look at the tests, sigh at the results, discuss the follow-up, the new prescriptions, the second and third opinions. I'm supposed to take my x-rays into St. Petersburg to see the new specialist, but I stop when I see her, my hand on the handle of the car, and there she is, in a golf cart. She doesn't golf. Everyone has golf carts down here. Margaret whizzing by with a hat on at a jaunty angle, a cigarette stabbing up into the air like a sex change Roosevelt, and Bob in the seat next to her. His golf hat blows off. Bob makes a grab for it, but it's gone. Margaret laughs. They both laugh, and the golf cart zooms off through a row of forsythia. That night, Bob's late when he comes in. He kisses me on the forehead, sits close on the ottoman. How was the doctor? What did he say? I say, fine. His bald head is burned. His bald head, which has made him fear skin cancer since the age of 36, on which he smears three kinds of sunscreen with an SPF of 198, this before he puts on his hat, is burnt to a crisp. You're red, I say. A little, Bob says. He is sanguine about his head and the carcinoma that is steadily brightening over it. Where's your hat? Lost it. Bob is relaxed about the loss of his hat, his favorite hat, the hat he got when he and the fellas won the Riddle Skin Senior 2 years before. Bob gets angry if he loses a pack of matches from Albertsons, but today he could care less if he lost his favorite first-place trophy hat. I show him the invitation. His brow furrows, red and white grooves, as he pretends not to know about the cocktail party. Should we go? He asks. Well, it's up to you, he says. Would you be comfortable? He takes my hand. He's very solicitous. He's like Marcus Welby. I say, no. He nods again. He wants to go. The bastard. Okay, he says, we won't. We'll be the only ones, though, and that'll stick out. Bob goes into the kitchen, and he takes his pills. I call to him, all right, we'll go, but we won't stay long. Bob is ecstatic, but he shakes his head. Oh, no, really, if it's uncomfortable, if it makes you feel inhibited or shy. Note the problem. It's not that she stole my husband from me, then threw him back like a dead fish. It's that I'm too intimidated by her blazing light to be in the room with her. No, I say, we're going. Bob sighs, pops a beta blocker. If you say so, he says. Tom Sawyer thinks he's made the dumb girl paint another fence.
Lucy Stickler.
And we'll leave it up to those folks out there to guess who is the victim of this particular murder.
Yes.
Or who are the victims of this particular murder.
Now, Richard Block, what is the director's job when you're directing a staged reading where everybody's just kind of sitting there and a lot of it is in the imagination of the audience?
Yes, well, directing a reading is very different from directing a play. The real requirement is to listen and then feed back to the actor, maybe an idea here or an idea there. You can't keep doing too much because it's, the actors in this case don't have lots of preparation time. So you're giving them an idea or a thought or a character idea and then sort of to put the whole thing in a kind of perspective. For instance, the choice of how to play these different characters is something we'd sort of work on together. How serious are they? How lighthearted are they? Whatever. So it's fun. In this case, it's a lot of fun because the monologues are so funny. And each of these three people performing are so fine at doing what they do.
Three wonderful actors, three wonderful murderers, one great director, Richard Block. The evening is called Murderers. It's a play by Jeffrey Hatcher, staged reading on Friday, June 6th at 7:30 at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and it's for the benefit of the Santa Fe Art Institute. And please RSVP so they can figure out how many chairs to set up. The number is 424-5050, but I suppose a few people could come at the last minute without a reservation if they really wanted to.
I'm sure they will, and we welcome them all. One of the reasons we'd like to have an RSVP is to know how much food to prepare.
There will be food?
There will be snick snacks. And let me say that contributions for this are tax deductible, so that whatever you choose to give at the door will be is a tax deduction.
Lois Viscoli, Karen Lee, and Richard Block, not to mention Minka Lupino and Lucy Stickler, thanks so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for having us. We've had fun.
Thank you so much.
And where do you live?
I can't remember.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back here on KSFR Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'd like to welcome Dagoberto Gilb. He is an author whose latest book is The Flowers, published by Grove Press. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
So the main character of your novel is a 15-year-old Chicano boy named Sonny, whose mother remarries this guy who's basically a redneck alcoholic who runs a small apartment complex in Los Angeles. Tell us how you developed this very appealing character of Sonny.
You know, it's always funny when I get this. It's like, I know that the world is full of, like, inventing the new writing world. Everybody invents from, they sit in a room and, invent little worlds like it's Super Mario Brothers. Whereas in my case, things sort of, like, the only way I can invent is sort of when it's sort of throbbing and I invent things around the throbbing physical contact I've had. And so all this to say that I didn't create them in the sense that, people create sort of like a cartoon character. I it's from my own life to the degree that, I lived in an apartment complex and I had a stepfather like that. And my mother was a single, she married a man similar to this and like that. Sort of the traditional way that fiction has been written over the years, where, you know, it didn't used to be so odd to do that.
So is Sonny somebody who you feel like is kind of your 15-year-old self?
Well, I think whenever a writer writes, everybody is his own self.
Right.
And yes, I know his experience very well. It's not my experience. My experience sort of like ins and outs. There's various ins and outs of it that are close to my experience. But when you're writing fiction, even the, quote, actual factual things that you could point to aren't really what happened. You know, there's, for instance, there's a pervert in the story who, you know, in some sense I've obsessed, in my own life, I obsessed over a guy that was following me when I was young. And so I got my revenge on him, a guy that was just, you know, bothering me when I was a young guy, like following me in a car. And I sort of took it out on him. It's not him. I had no experience like anything like Sonny does in the book. There's nothing even similar, except, yeah, I could say, yeah, there was this sick dude that was like pursuing me. But does that mean it's autobiographical? No, it doesn't at all. It's not at all what happened to me, except that the experience happened to me, and that's what I mean. So an apartment complex, which when you're from California and, you know, a lot of places now, but cities and usually in the West, these apartment complexes become very ordinary for all of us, and it is the way we live now.
One thing that is really well drawn and well written in this novel is the tremendous sensitivity that young people have, that this particular character has, to the nonverbal signals of everybody around him. He can, you know, he can detect phoniness or any kind of deception a mile away, and likewise, he knows who's leveling with him as well. And I was thinking about, you know, what does it take to get into this adolescent headspace? Is that something that we lose as adults?
Well, I worked real hard to get the voice, you know, to work on a voice that was both, you know, from the past and could be translated as current too, you know, so you know, that was the effort that I put the most work into when I was working on this book, and it's the thing, ironically, that's caused it the most grief in terms of getting published. Everybody thought I was the character, and I didn't use artifice, but I don't really think he is 15 in the slightest. So it's hard for me to sort of, I think he's much more like any adult. We all have that character, or at least men. I think actually women can be women at 14. In some sense, they begin women issues at around that time. But it's all that time when we become adult, and we're kind of right at the crossroads of adult and childhood. And that's what I was dealing with. So a lot of the issues in the book aren't even close to being youthful, really. They're just sort of innocent.
Yeah. What do you mean when you say you've gotten grief for that voice, well, that you worked hard on? I love the voice of this character.
Well, it's funny because, you know, when you send to New York, New York sees this sort of ignorant, funny guy that doesn't speak in appropriate English or whatever the hell they think when they read it, when they read it, and mostly just, and it's a voice they're not used to hearing, especially since it's a Mexican-American, I think. They have no familiarity with the voice, and so they thought it was me writing in my normal, in my normal voice and in my normal compositional way, as if I don't know the rules of speech. I was capturing a dialect, and they weren't thinking it was a dialect. They thought it was just how my bad English was.
Oh, my goodness. That's shocking. I mean,
it was pretty surprising to me, particularly. It's not surprising. Well, stepping back, in the first place, it's not surprising to me to the to the extent that I've always gotten it. I have, like, now 25 years of experience, and I have been getting these kinds of reactions, you know, from the beginning. When you're a younger, you know, particularly younger writer, it's something you sort of, you know, when they're telling you that, you know, you need to do this, and, you know, if you write harder, work harder, this will happen and that happens. What I didn't realize is sort of the form of discussing, well, it's the form that racism comes in toward us. It's the sort of patronizing that if you work harder and you work on your English skills, you'll get better. Now, it shocked me that after 25 years and all my, you know, what would seem to be a credibility, that I was still getting this from the literary establishment. And it's not the establishment as sort of like hoity-toities necessarily, although there's maybe that. But it's also simply that they are not aware of the American West and the Southwest and Mexican Americans. They don't have any clue. And so they immediately assume whenever it's not in their norm, that it's something like almost retarded or a little lesser. And so the fact that even though I have all this other, this history as a writer, I was still getting treated because this character's voice, I would still hear reactions from people like, well, you know, I don't know. And it was, you know, the subtext was that this isn't mature enough for us, this guy's voice. And anybody that really actually read the story would know immediately that this is not about a young, you know, is not young in the sense of what they are thinking.
No, I mean, it's
patronizing way they're reading it.
The book is incredibly well observed. I read every single word of it, and I really savored it. I read it really slowly. I was trying to read it fast, but I couldn't because the way that you captured the voice of this character was really, really skillful. It reminded me, frankly, of Huckleberry Finn, with, you know, the consistent voice that it was written in, the young man's independence, living by his wits, his observation of race relations and things like that. Did you think about Huck Finn when you were writing it?
Well, I first have to just compliment you on your high intelligence. but no. I mean, I know the book. I know Huck Finn, but no, not at all. And to be honest with you, you know, it's just as funny because I've been having, the book's been out a while, and I just suddenly realized that he's a 15-year-old in some sense that it hadn't even been in my mind. I didn't hear him as a 15-year-old exactly. It's, you know, I was just capturing a voice and a character, and I guess it just sort of has been sort of my own surprise and my own stupidity, probably, to not realize that I was writing as a 15-year-old when I was just trying to capture this young, innocent Chicano voice. And, yeah, I just didn't realize that. But I have to tell you, I truly admire that voice, and even, yeah, the voice of Huck Finn, but also Richard Wright, you know, even his in Black Boy, you know, he's a young guy. And things like that. I do admire those books. I realize that, oh, well, that's where my, you know, I have an admiration for that kind of book. But I didn't realize I was doing that in the slightest. I truly saw him as a young adult. And I don't even mean young adult in that YA way. I'm just like finding myself at a loss for language. I just saw him as a young guy and didn't for a second think he was, you know, like, quote, 15, unquote.
One theme I wanted to talk to you about was you notice while reading it that Sonny and the other young people in the book have been raised without really any connection to wild nature. There's this great line. He's talking about his new stepfather's furniture, and he says, "I don't think I'd ever seen so much wood, even in a picture of a forest," which is so great. And, you know, because he's never seen a forest, it's just a picture of a forest. But he has this great, rich, imaginative inner life, and it's such an interesting picture of just working with whatever you've got.
Again, you're such an insightful, great reader.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate it. It's totally an urban. It's urban. It's an urban person, and a young urban man. The innocence of being urban is being completely naive to the outer world. And it is like what a huge percentage of the population lives like. They really don't know nature, and a lot of these discussions that you would have about nature and the outside world is really just viewed through television and things like that. They really have no clue. And in that respect, I guess I'm as guilty of that, having grown up in urban Los Angeles myself. You know, I never even crossed my mind that I wasn't, where I was, as anybody. You don't know where you are until you step away from where you've been. And then you see where you grew up, and you have no idea. I always, in some sense, like Sonny, you know, I can remember places in Los Angeles near railroad tracks where it seemed like the wilderness completely to me. And, you know, the fact is it was only like, you know, maybe it was 100 feet wide around the tracks, 50 feet on either side, and on, you know, on sort of like sloped, like almost cliff-like slopes. And you took that as sort of like being in a jungle or in a cowboy movie out there. It was just the only for like 5 minutes a day would you encounter that space.
And the character is so resourceful, not just with what he's able to do, but also just with his imagination. You know, given what he's got, you know, given the really lack of parental attention and lack of attention from teachers in his school and really, you know, any kind of really attentive adults and lack of nature and lack of all sorts of things, he still is a great kid, and he does so much with what he has. And I noticed that color is used to express emotional experience. It was really vivid, and I was wondering if you could talk about that.
You know, it's funny, a close friend of mine called me just a couple days ago to talk about this. You know, it's called synesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people that see colors when they eat or have certain experiences, they see colors. Sexual experiences, they'll see colors and shapes and things like this. Now, I mean, she insists that she has this incredible wealth of synesthesiac or whatever experiences. And I guess I'd have some, but I think you could say it's that. But yes, the thing I did in the novel was use that as his only source of what otherwise is pretty colorless in the world that he lives in. And it was willful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. The another theme in the book is kind of the disintegration of the links to Mexico and to the Spanish language. And even the name of the book, The Flowers, is about the apartment complex called The Flower or The Flowers or Los Flores instead of Las Flores.
Right. Well, yeah, and to that extent, it's like what happens to a Mexican-American kid who grows up in a culture where sort of there's this admiration, or I don't even know if that's not the right word, admiration, but sort of the allure of the Spanish or the Mexican culture, even though they have nothing to do with it, and so they don't even know the language, and so they'll, you know, use the language to name a street or something, or a building in this case, and misuse it, thinking that flowers being flores and not really looking up, you know, what the appropriate article for it is.
Right.
So instead of Las Flores, they named the building Los Flores. And a lot of that disconnect with something significantly that's more important is throughout the book, that same disconnection. And, of course, the Mexican-American community is very much disconnected to its roots in Mexico and in some sense nostalgic sometimes and sometimes you know, less nostalgic about what Mexico is, but the disconnection is, of course, what he has and what he reflects, and really reflects a huge part of the community. To know that they're supposedly part of it, but to be so far away from it, it's as distant as nature is.
And then he's very drawn to a young woman who's Mexican and who really is Mexican and is from Mexico and speaks Spanish and is very rooted in Mexico. And her name is Nika, but she has lots of different names, and she longs for an American name. And it's a very tender relationship between the two characters.
Right. Again, it's that level of sort of sweetness that I, that maybe that could be called young. I just call it, we all have that in us. And it just is more noticeable when you're young. But, yeah, sort of a loss and, you know, appreciation of this person that's just thrown into this, into that urban wilderness, and it's just completely inappropriate for it. And is scared. In some sense, in her case, she's stuck in a little small space by sort of like, I guess you could almost call them abusive parents, at least just unaware parents. But everybody in the novel is, has the same basic selfish interest. Everybody's into their own selfish self-interest, and so it's she's no different, but she's just she's the utter form of innocence that you could be, with no responsibility and only doing good and not knowing anything, you know, not being responsible for what's going on around her. And even as she's not responsible, her behavior is pretty good.
Now, while all this is going on, Sonny is adding a language, which is so, it's again, it's very endearing. He decides that he wants to go to Notre Dame, but he doesn't mean the college. He means the church, Notre Dame in France, and he wants to learn French. And French, the French language, becomes this sort of refuge for him.
Right. Yeah, no, it's, I love that. I mean, you know, I there's several things going on with the French. It's his form of playfulness. It's how he... he smiles through this otherwise pretty bleak-looking world. It makes him laugh, and it makes him, you know, it's his way of sarcasm. It's all these things that make him feel, you know, give him sort of a spirit. But at the same time, he's doing that. For me, it's also a way of playing, too, as the writer. It's my little, to use the French, petit homage to Jean Genet,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, Our Lady of the Flowers. I sort of like have indebtedness to these kind of writers that broke rules and literary rules. And so in a certain sense, I'm, you know, willfully trying to break some rules, because the cliche about Mexican-American writers is it's always about Spanish and it's always about this other stuff. And I was trying to sort of assert something else about what we are able to do. We can do other things, too, besides be locked down by these identity politics. But with that, I'm also being playful and playing with the idea that I like Jean Genet, who was a, you know, pretty explicit gay writer who was in prison as a thief. And so in some sense, Sonny is a little bit like that. So that little play I'm doing in the book is about me sort of like talking about, hey, I like Jean Genet, and that's why it's called The Flowers.
It really is amazing. I mean, we're here in the Southwest. I've lived here for a long time. And once you've been here for a while, you notice really how much more provincial New York is, or the Northeast is, than we are, because we know what's going on in the Northeast, and they've got no idea what's going on down here.
Oh, there's absolutely no question that's true. And it's not even their fault. I mean, you can see it so well. It causes us problems. You know, as artists and writers, they go after our most commercial and cliched work, generally, and respond to it out of their own expectations of stereotypes and cliches. But it's definitely true that they're very limited and almost provincial in their outlook. It's pretty amazing, particularly about the American Southwest. I think a writer like me, who's one from the West, which is not understood well or appreciated much in our literary capital, which is an unavoidable fact, it's in New York City. So they don't care much about the West, or they don't understand it except as a tourist place. But then the American Southwest, which doubles the trouble, because the American Southwest is even more sparse. It's not Los Angeles. It's not San Francisco. And then finally, the last thing is Mexican-Americans, which... to top it off, we've gotten this anti-immigrant bias, and even in New York, they're just not, they're not even appreciating Mexican people. So Mexican-Americans being sort of the subgroup around that is sort of all around this sort of not getting it, not understanding who we are, our history, and I mean in the most minuscule ways they don't get it. And so, yeah, it's, they just don't They don't know. Earlier you mentioned the nature. Well, they themselves, and it's easy to see how it happens after a couple, 2-3 years living in New York City, where really the only things they pay attention to are conversations. And, it's such a vertical life where they don't really have much nature. They have rain, they have snow, but those are just intrusions on their urban existence. So we writers from the West, we definitely have a lot to go up against.
Yeah, I mean, that contrast between a totally or primarily verbal life and a nonverbal life is really a big one. And then, I think there's, even when there's a kind of appreciation of, let's say, Latino culture or literature or whatever, there's also an expectation that it's going to include, curanderos and magical realism or something.
Well, that's a lot of silly stuff that my own community itself has perpetuated to at some point I'm just so tired of hearing about it that it's just so silly to me. I don't know where that's coming from, why it's coming from so much. I actually think it's not a description, but it's more prescription.
Right.
Everybody wants that to be true. It just happens to not be as true as it's been made out to be, unto the point where everybody expects everybody to be living this way and believing this way and thinking this sort of vaguely new agey way.
Right.
And then, of course, our artists ourselves, we are expected to dress up, in sombreros and wear huaraches or dress like Frida Kahlo or whatever the heck,
right,
sort of to be our culture to them, which is the other thing I was trying to, the fact is Jean Genet, that French writer, and that kind of literary life and that artistic life influenced me, as it does to people in Mexico. I mean, Diego Rivera, one of the greatest artists of all time in all places, went to Europe. He lived in Paris, and he was influenced by Parisian art, so that when he came home, he was able to learn how to paint his own culture. And this is the way of all art, and all it has never been any different. But somehow, even in our own community, we've gotten so silly about this stuff that we even look for it in each other, expect it from each other. In L.A., it's the funny thing is everybody thinks that they have to have a gang life past in some sense. And,
right.
And it's all just ridiculous. It's just not true. I mean, there is that exists, but it's like expecting every white guy to have a biker past.
Right. Or to have an Ivy League past,
Right, one of those, yeah. Just somehow one or the other, or you're not real.
It's interesting because the two best novels I've read in the last 6 months are this one and then Sherman Alexie's book, Flight, which is also told in the first person from the point of view of a 15-year-old boy who goes through all sorts of changes. In fact, he reincarnates into different people's bodies before he comes back. And it's another book that totally busts stereotypes about Native Americans. And it's just it's a great book. You are of German and Mexican origin, and many of us in this country at this point are mixed races and mixed cultures. And yet the kind of prejudices and animosities that you portray in this book, The Flowers, are still very much alive. What kinds of changes have you seen, and what kind of changes do you think that we're going through in this country in terms of people opening their minds culturally and racially?
Well, I am, in that respect, I'm very much like an Obama, to the degree that I'm of mixed heritage. The fact that I mostly grew up I didn't even grow up with my own father, so I don't really know his culture. And the fact that he was German in descent has nothing to do with my cultural upbringing. I know nothing about him or it, really, except in the most rude, in terms of work, he gave me jobs. But anyway, I just think that I really think there's this new generation and a new time, and I wish I could start over and do it again just with that, because I think it's so much more healthy. I'm hoping, I have a lot of hope, and I think that there is a change. Young people now grow up in a completely mixed society. Everybody's mixed. We're all mixed. And I think that's the great thing, the greatest subtext of this Obama campaign, whether it succeeds or not. Now, I do hope it succeeds, but to the degree that particularly young people are very much aware of our mixed racial cultures, mixed races and mixed cultures, and I just think I'm just thrilled. I want to scream for joy all the time. Like I say, when I go to readings and they're young people, they so understand the complicatedness. And yes, the book represents what's still out there a lot, and it is what I grew up in Los Angeles in particular, being one of the most racist places on earth, comparable, I guess, only to, like, Philadelphia and maybe Chicago, where there's multi-ethnic groups, which is like Los Angeles. It's still there, but, yeah, I think people from, like, I don't even know what age group, but it's changed. You go to the schools, and there's no option but to change, because it has. It's this oncoming tide of difference, and I think it's just great.
What's your connection to the Spanish language? To what extent did you grow up speaking Spanish, and how comfortable is Spanish for you now compared to English?
My Spanish is good. Like every Mexican-American, we always think it's terrible, and sometimes it is. But my Spanish isn't bad. I can do it fine. I recently even did it publicly, and that was strange. And in Mexico, I never thought I would ever have the guts to speak publicly in Spanish, but I even did that. That was unique and fun, and now I want to do it more. But, you know, I grew up, my mother was Mexican and spoke Spanish. I mean, at some point she married white guys, so, you know, it just sort of stopped. And then the white guys, he'd stopped speaking Spanish. So my Spanish as a kid was probably like a 9-year-old, an 8 to 10-year-old, maybe.
Right.
Which is sort of like a lot of us. I mean, a lot of us don't really go much beyond that. The irony is that a lot of people that just assume that your Spanish is equivalent to reading like Don Quixote or something, and it's like that's just such an outrageously ridiculous idea. You have to, like, expecting kids in high school to read Shakespeare and get it.
Well, I just want to ask you one more question before we go, and that is, maybe this is a silly question, but this was one of those novels, The Flowers. When I finished it, the characters walked around with me for days afterwards, and I really thought about them, and as in many good novels, you sort of feel like these people are your friends. What's it like for you as an author once you finish the book? What do you do with these characters?
Well, I walked around with them for years. And a lot of the stuff that you're dealing with as an author is like, how are people going to, like Cindy, who I think gets a bad rap, you know, but Cindy's like a character we all, in an apartment building, an apartment complex, everybody knows who she is, but yeah, so I...
She's the married woman who's not very happy with her husband.
Right, and you know, she's a kid too, she's 19, she doesn't know, she's just made a huge lot of mistakes. That are mistakes of the working poor. And these are all these working poor people that are, in some level, they're almost just being human beings, and you just one little nick in the navigation system, and you find yourself way down south instead of where you wanted to go, where you might have gone just had you not been touched at that point. You wouldn't have, like, 100 miles later been so off track. But I'm just extraordinarily grateful that you say this, because it pleases me so much. Thanks for saying that. I couldn't be happier to hear what you just said.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Dagoberto Gilb, author of the new novel, The Flowers.
Thanks so much for letting me speak.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.